European leaders say, pay no attention to the ratings agencies.
We've got a continent and a currency to save.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, December 6th.
Coming up, Ireland makes some big cuts to help make ends meet.
The payroll tax debate continues to rattle some nerves in Washington.
And a wild and woolly commercial from Brooks Brothers has us asking, what are those scarves really made out of?
That's later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner arrived in Germany today for a three-day European visit, and he's playing a couple of roles there.
He's reminding the leaders that the U.S. is an important economic partner, a very, very important partner. And then he's this cheerleader, too, telling European leaders, yay, you can do it, you can make it through this terrible financial crisis. Asking them, of course, to take bold action to save the continent's economy and, of course, the euro.
Geithner's visit comes the same day Standard & Poor's said it could cut the credit ratings of all the eurozone countries and, in fact, may even downgrade the European bailout fund itself, the one that's helping Greece and Ireland and Portugal, too.
Now, we'll get to all of that coming up. First, now, Secretary Geithner's trip, and the BBC's Steve Evans is with us from Berlin. Hey, Steve.
Hi.
So the Treasury Secretary arrives in Germany today. What's his role in all of this?
I think his role is to tell Europeans that if the euro crashes, well, then everybody suffers. I think his role is to say it's a serious matter. You really do need to sort this thing out.
Talk about this S&P warning that they could downgrade all of the eurozone nations if those nations can't get the debt situation under control. How's that been received in Germany today?
Well, not very well, really. German politicians and French politicians are saying, look, we're putting the measures in place. We're doing what we can do. And Italy, for example, has improved its finances markedly. So we think that your warning is misplaced. Its effect on the financial markets is probably not very great. But people are saying, what's the timing all about? Why do this in this particular week?
And what are we going to hear later this week when this big European Union summit happens in Brussels?
We don't know. This is summit number, I don't know, I've lost count. This is the one that's supposed to sort out the problems. And they all know that if this one doesn't, then it does get serious. What remains to be seen is whether there is a serious plan in place. We know what Chancellor Merkel and Mr. Sarkozy want, much more control of the finances of eurozone countries. But the question is whether the European Central Bank will now start to get a bit freer with its money and so satisfy the markets that something real is happening.
The BBC Steve Evans in Berlin. Steve, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Geithner's visit comes just a day after Ireland announced nearly $2 billion in stiff budget cuts. It's been a year since Ireland had to be bailed out by its European neighbors.
Austin Hughes is chief economist at KBC Bank in Ireland. He's with us now from Dublin. Hi, Austin.
Good morning.
I know Ireland has just unveiled this newest round of cuts. And, you know, we've seen a lot of other measures taken so far. Is Ireland's economy getting back on track?
I think it's too early to say we're getting back on track, but it's certainly weathered a good deal of the storm. The cuts that we're announcing in this budget are just the latest installment. They account to about 2.5% of Ireland's GDP this year. We've had a sharp enough hit to personal incomes. You can imagine unemployment has risen. So it's been fairly tough, but there are some signs that the Irish economy is beginning to stabilize.
How has life changed, do you think, for everyday Irish folks?
It's changed dramatically. We have about 15% fewer people at work. That's a massive decline in headcount. It's a reduction in numbers at work of a scale that hasn't been seen in most other countries. Alongside that, we've had very significant tax increases. We've had major reductions in welfare entitlements. So it's been a very, very tough time.
Austin Hughes from KBC Bank in Ireland in Dublin. Thank you, Austin.
All the best.
Well, today, President Obama will be in Kansas, where he's expected to make another push for the extension of the payroll tax cut, which expires at the end of the year. So far, Democrats and Republicans in Congress can't agree on whether to extend it, and if they do, how to pay for it.
And if no deal is reached by the end of the year, the Treasury Department says the average family will be out $1,000 a year. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports.
Back in 1935, Franklin D. Roosevelt introduced the payroll tax so that everyone would chip in to Social Security.
Something that everyone would buy into politically. It wouldn't be a class warfare issue. It wouldn't be the rich against the poor. It would be something all Americans were equally invested in.
Richard DeKayser is deputy chief economist with the Parthenon Group. That tax was cut by 2% last year. President Obama has proposed extending the tax break to next year as well. The political debate is over how to keep paying for Social Security if that occurs. Democrats want to tax millionaires. Republicans want to increase premiums for Medicare. Richard DeKayser says that cutting payroll taxes is a good way to stimulate the economy.
It's targeted to low and moderate income individuals. These are folks who spend every dime that they can get their hands on, especially in difficult times such as the present. More income to these individuals more rapidly translates through to direct spending in our economy.
And that's a message even Roosevelt could have gotten behind. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis on the payroll tax debate now with Julie Niemann of Smith, Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So, Julie, the Treasury Department says that if they don't extend this thing, the average family will pay $1,000 more per year in their tax bill. But if Congress can't agree on how to pay for this, can the government really afford to do it?
Well, the key thing is 70% of our economic growth really comes from consumer spending. Consumer spending has been increasing somewhat, but it's largely due to higher prices. It's going into the gas tank, into the furnace, medical, and food. Only some buying has been in manufactured or household goods, and that's what's required to tow the economy out of the ditch. That kind of buying creates jobs. So the people who are spending are middle and low income that directly and efficiently stimulates the economy by putting coins in the jeans of consumers. Now, how do you pay for it? Well, the ultra-rich with paychecks over $1 million a year will have a tiny 1.9% additional tax to be levied. And, of course, Fannie and Freddie Mac will have fee increases. So they're counterbalancing with, yes, an increase in some areas.
But, Julie, if they do that, aren't we just shifting what would be consumer debt over to the federal government at a time of huge deficits?
Well, the key thing here is we have to get back to our normal growth rate, 3 to 3.5% gross domestic product. If we eliminate senseless Bush tax cuts that only help the rich, make a start on reform of the tax code, combine those three things, and we can grow our way out of this. Europe, by contrast, doesn't have the ability to really grow their way out. The Club Med countries produce olive oil, lemons, and swell vacation spots for Northerners. But they have to have a huge draconian budget cut to deal with crushing debt. We can actually grow our way out.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith, Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, Jeremy, Julie, Bank of America has agreed to pay $315 million to settle investors' claims that the bank misled them about mortgage securities offerings by its Merrill Lynch unit. That's going to need court approval, though.
Las Vegas giant Steve Wynn wants to build a casino in Foxborough, Massachusetts, but as part of the state's new law allowing casinos, Wynn is going to have to convince the community of Foxborough to let him build. So he said yesterday, don't worry, the casino will blend right in with the New England scenery. I'm sure that that means it won't have any Eiffel Towers or pyramids, Steve.
Or neon, a bunch of neon. Right. Well, maybe there will be some neon, who knows. IMAX said today it signed deals to open 7 more theaters in China and 2 more in Indonesia. The giant domed movie screen maker wants Asia to be at least a quarter of its market in the next few years. A little later on the program, singer Adele has some specific taste in beer.
And you could be able to soon visit Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
What?
And ride a roller coaster while you're at it. But is a Harry Potter theme park an automatic winner?
Wow.
That's ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. We got news this morning that economic growth across the Eurozone was up just 0.2% last quarter. Now, when we get figures like that, we're mostly getting a sense of what's going on in the formal, above-board economy, the one in which people pay taxes and they follow labor laws.
But, Steve, journalist Robert Neuwirth says there is a lot more to it than that. He has just written a book called Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, first of all, describe the informal economy. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's all the businesses that fly under the radar of government attention or government control. Businesses that may not get registered, may not get licensed, and may not be paying taxes, but are doing business in legal product, just in a quasi-legal way.
And you say that half of the workers in the world are working in jobs that are off the books right now.
Absolutely. It's 1.8 billion people, and that will rise to two-thirds of the workers in the world by the end of this decade.
Why are so many people operating in this informal economy?
Well, the formal economy is not working for people. It's very simple. It's a combination of too many rules and regulations that cost too much for people and people just trying to survive in a difficult economy.
So you think that we should embrace this informal economy?
Absolutely. I think it's imperative that we embrace it. Totally in the world, about $10 trillion worth of trade is happening this way. So, I mean, I don't think we're talking about embracing criminality. I think we're talking about finding an alternate way for people to develop the economy that reaches further into the population so that more people are doing well.
Maybe it reaches further into the population, but it also probably doesn't have labor laws, ways to settle business disputes in court or anything like that.
Look, I think that's a canard. Labor laws are not very well developed in most of the world, although they are here. And as far as business disputes, informal marketplaces around the world are creating their own courts to be able to adjudicate and solve disputes between buyers and sellers. So it's not unsystematic. It's just happening beneath the radar.
Robert Neuwirth's new book is called Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Some good economic news, Jeremy. Today out of China for U.S. automakers who sell cars there. Things have been looking up lately. From Shanghai Marketplace, China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
GM today reported its November sales in China shot up at their fastest pace in 10 months. Ford reported its sales in China are up 7% this year. All proof that in these tough economic times, somebody, somewhere is buying something. That would be people in China are buying cars. Beijing-based auto industry expert Michael Lasky says the China market for a company like GM is outpacing sluggish sales in Europe.
Year on year, the numbers are up, and I think the U.S. companies are starting to position themselves well in terms of the types of vehicles that the market wants.
And for China, it all starts with affordability. Sales of Ford's low-cost Mondeo model saw a 61% increase this year in China.
It's got to have good fuel economy. And the Chinese consumer wants a lot of technology inside the car.
Like a GPS system. They'll need it to navigate the 400,000 miles of new roads the government says it built in the past 5 years in China. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Syrian activists say the latest violence there has killed nearly three dozen people. That's as clashes continue between pro-democracy demonstrators and police loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. One of the issues protesters are angry about is the government's system of crony capitalism, where friends and relatives of the Syrian president benefit economically from those relationships. Reese Ehrlich reports from Damascus.
For some people in Syria, Rami Makhlouf, owner of the cell phone company Syriatel, is the very model of a successful entrepreneur. He made a small private company into a multi-billion dollar cell phone powerhouse.
How was Excuse me. That's all right?
Here in a Damascus cell phone shop, this salesman considers Makhlouf a local hero.
What is your opinion of him as a businessman?
He's
a very good person.
Several months ago, however, pro-democracy demonstrators expressed their anger at Makhlouf by burning Syriatel SIM cards. For them, Makhlouf became rich because he's the cousin of President Bashar al-Assad. A group of pro-democracy activists drive to a clandestine location near the old city of Damascus. An activist using the pseudonym Lean says under the guise of liberalizing the economy, the Syrian government enriched a loyal group of crony capitalists. Her voice has been distorted to protect her identity.
I think Rami Makhlouf is a symbol for corruption in Syria, but it's not he's the only man our government, they make the corruption deeper and deeper.
He's a symbol, but he's not the only one.
Yeah.
But Lean and other activists no longer burn SIM cards. They discovered that if the government doesn't know who owns the SIM card, cell phones are ideal for clandestinely organizing demonstrations. Another activist named Ahmad says protesters now buy lots and lots of SIM cards.
It's not important, you know, to burn the SIM cards because we use them and we need to pay our bills to make the revolution.
In Damascus, Omri Serlik for Marketplace.
Researchers from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography will present new findings today that link air pollution from Asia to winter storms in California. Is all that dirt and dust causing more of the white stuff on the West Coast? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explains.
Air pollution from dust storms in central China has been wafting over to the U.S. for years. Now, researchers say it may be intensifying precipitation in California's Sierra Nevada. Atmospheric chemist Kim Prather compared cloud particles from two winter storms there. One contained lots of local air pollutants, mainly wood smoke. The other, mostly dust pollution from China's deserts. Turns out the China dust produced a lot more precipitation.
It was about 1.4 times as much snow coming down. And from the standpoint of collecting our water supply, if it comes down in the form of snow, that's considered better for us because it's an easier way to store our water supply in California.
That's possibly the most positive spin you can put on dust pollution, but Prather cautions much more research is needed.
You know, there's lots of reasons you can get a lot more snowfall.
Prather plans to continue sampling the pollutants in California's snowfall for more clues. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Now to the British singer Adele, who has a rider in her contract that stipulates the following, Steve, according to the website The Smoking Gun. At every concert, there has to be a small plate of individually wrapped sandwiches that do not contain tomatoes, vinegar, chili, or citrus fruit.
Wow, those okay? Four specific items.
That's exactly right. Okay. They're also on the tour bus have to be chocolate bars, the miniature size.
Oh, really?
Mars, Milky Way, Twix, stuff like that.
Sounds good. Yeah, I can get that.
Okay, and she wants 12 bottles of the best quality European lager 12. Beer.
Yes, 12 that, bottles.
Always 12.
Wow. Yeah.
And it actually says in the contract that North American beer is not acceptable.
Oh, no.
At all.
Oh, man.
I guess we know now what she meant when she said we could have had it all. She did have it all. Microsoft is revamping Xbox Live today. It's trying to turn what began as a gaming console into a premium cable box to compete with the satellite and cable companies. Apple is planning to do the same thing next year by selling its own brand of television set. As Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, tech giants are looking to take control of your living room.
Interactive TV is the next consumer electronics battleground. James McQuivey is a consumer product strategist at Forrester Research.
There's enough at stake here. Remember, this is 4 to 5 hours a day for the average adult in the United States that they spend on the television.
Americans spend billions on their TVs, whether on their cable bills or streaming movies. The networks earn billions more selling ads. Tech companies want a piece. They're fighting to convince movie and TV studios to let them stream more content online.
And remember, every single one of these studios could be bought and sold by Apple, Google, Microsoft even. And that's a really, really tough position to be in as a content provider when you think content is king. But in reality, these companies are superior. They're the emperor.
And how Americans watch TV is changing. McQuivey says folks want to watch what they want when they want it, on any device. Technology can make this happen, and it might just transform what we all think of as a big, dumb box. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, from themed entertainment at home, Jeremy, to a theme park that hopes to dazzle kids who have done some reading or perhaps some movie watching in the past decade.
Yeah, today, Universal Studios Hollywood is expected to start building a new Wizarding World of Harry Potter attraction here in Southern California. Now, there may be no books and films coming out, but the Potter brand still seems to be worth a lot. According to reports, the Orlando location of the Harry Potter attraction brought in over 7 million people in the first years of operation and helped increase Universal's visitor numbers by 36% in the first quarter. Well, in today's Midday Extra, we ask, are Harry Potter and other franchises like that the future of theme parks? And here to talk with us about that is Eric Yates, editor of BehindTheThrills.com. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Eric.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, let me ask you first, is this thesis correct here? Does Harry Potter and stuff like that, is that what's going to bring people into theme parks from now on?
That's a really tough question because you have so many great creative minds, but the public mindset, and I don't mean this derogatory, but the public mindset is really such a short attention span. You have to use a big name. You have to use a name like Harry Potter, Avatar, something that will grab the attention. And then once you have their attention, wow them with what you absolutely can do within the realms of your park. So short answer is yes. I think this is what you're going to see more and more often now.
How are theme parks, Eric, doing here in the economic downturn? Have they been doing all right?
Surprisingly, yes. You have very few parks that are reporting a decrease in attendance, where more and more parks every year just are reporting such a huge increase that they're scrambling to keep up with it. That's why you have the Wizarding World of Harry Potter going in Hollywood. You have huge expansions happening at Disney, SeaWorld. Everybody's just expanding to try to draw as many people and get as many new things as humanly possible to keep people coming back.
Is that because people want to sort of escape their doldrums, or is that what – I mean, it is kind of an escape for people, right?
It absolutely is for me. It is really, truly an escape and a lot of places where you can go to just relax and see something completely out of the ordinary.
Is there a risk if you're tying something like Harry Potter to a theme park that it's going to be a fad that sort of goes out of style in a few years and they've just spent all this money on rides or whatever? You know, it's not going to be something that'll last like, say, the Matterhorn or Pirates of the Caribbean
who?
Or something.
What?
Yeah, who remembers those
the
things?
The Matterhorn.
Anymore? Exactly.
5 years ago, if you would have asked me that, I would have said, absolutely. There's no way that Harry Potter will succeed in 10 years. But seeing what Orlando has done with the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, rides and attractions like Harry Potter, like Shrek and Despicable Me, no matter how old the movies get, they create such a timeless experience, such as the Matterhorn and Pirates of the Caribbean. I honestly think that with those attractions, you're going to see them not only stick around for a long time, but become, yeah, dare I say, classics in the Disney mold as well.
But these are pretty elaborate parks that are going up. I mean, they're going to be expensive to get into. I mean, I know you can't get into Disneyland for, what, under $80-$90, right? I mean, and certainly with everything you have to buy inside or any of these theme parks. I mean, do people have the money for all this?
Yes and no. What a lot of the parks are doing now is they're going with the higher one-day ticket prices. That's to get you to buy the cheaper 2-3-day tickets or even the really cheap annual pass.
To make it a better bargain, right?
Absolutely. In contrast, here in Florida, you have Walt Disney World with a one-day ticket price of $85. Or for $500 or $400, roughly, you can get a whole year to come back to all four parks. So they're really going after that market. Sure, you can buy a one-day ticket, but it's cheaper if you stay 10 days, 7 days, come back all year.
I'm waiting for them to open the real Jurassic Park. then I will pay any price.
Really? You like that? Do you?
That's what I want.
Yeah. Eric Yates, editor of BehindTheThrills.com. Thanks so much for talking
with
us.
Thanks, Eric.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
And finally this morning, Jeremy, Brooks Brothers, you know, the high-end men's clothing store,
yeah,
has a new commercial out with a bunch of woolly lambs wearing cashmere scarves singing Jingle Bells.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh.
Aw, isn't that cute? Those are lambs.
Is this what you play when you go home?
They're cute, furry lambs.
You love it.
They're awesome.
You love the Christmas spirit, Steve.
I do, absolutely. All the right. Gist of the ad is that Brooks Brothers has been around much longer than even the song Jingle Bells. I think it predates Jingle Bells by like 40 years,
really?
Or something like that. Yeah.
Wow.
Now, the lambs have all these colorful stripes and patterned scarves showcasing a winter potpourri of style, but someone should have told the marketing folks that cashmere, Jeremy, comes from goats. not lambs.
You know, leave it to a Greek to figure that one out.
I'm just saying. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.